You're listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. For I Will Be With You. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible.
Welcome back to the For I Will Be With You podcast for the 41st week of the year from October 7th to October 13th, covering Numbers 24:5 to Numbers 27:18. Numbers 24:5 has a quote that is very famous in Jewish circles. It goes like this. It says, "How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel." And this is, if you've ever experienced this, one of the very first things it's said every morning in the Jewish prayer book, if you go to synagogue. And it is a quote that is uttered by Bilaam. Now, this might seem hard to believe, but just to recap, Bilaam is was a prophet. He was a wicked person, but he was a prophet of who understood when God was going to punish people. And Bilaam was asked by Balak, who was the king of Midian, a country that the Israelites were going to attack on their way into the Holy Land. He was asked by Balak to curse the Israelites. So previously we had this episode of Bilaam running out the door of his house to saddle up his donkey in order to run and curse the Israelites. But God has made Bilaam promise that he will only say what God wants him to say. And we have this funny kind of dichotomy of Bilaam being described in the Bible as a wicked person, but he's also willing to obey the word of God and has the ability to talk one-on-one with God, something that none of us have. We don't have that privilege. And when he shows up, he sees the Israelite encampment. Instead of cursing the Israelites, he says, "How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel." And so this, what was meant to be a curse, turns out to be a blessing. And it was so striking, important, that the Israelites took it to heart and have made it part of their liturgy. And maybe we can get inspired by this, because I think a lot of us are like Bilaam when we're active in our addictions. We're full of a drive to do the wrong thing, to defy the wishes of friends and loved ones, even God, to harm ourselves through selfish acting out. But if Bilaam, allegedly one of the most evil men who ever lived, can be brought into line to hear the true wisdom of God, then maybe so can we. We need to focus ourselves on understanding God's will for us, quieting down our egos and selfish drives. Then we can find serenity in recovery. Numbers 25:10 to 25:12 takes us to the next moment that's described in the Bible. And I'll tell you what happened first, and then I'll tell you what the verse says. After Bilaam has failed to curse the Israelites, the nation of Midian sends its daughters, its princesses, to tempt the Israelites into idolatry and sexual immorality, including a prince of the Israelites who's tempted into performing illicit sexual acts right in front of Moses. And Phinehas, who is a grandson of Aaron the Cohen, the priest, takes it upon himself to avenge this disgrace and kills the woman and the prince and right in front of Moses. And so God responds in Numbers 25:10 and says, God spoke to Moses saying, "Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, turn back my wrath from upon the children of Israel, when he zealously avenged my vengeance among them, so I did not consume the children of Israel in my vengeance. So Phinehas has taken action, and he's killed this Israelite prince who was cohabiting with the Midianite woman. And what happens, though, is that his decision, this decisive action, causes God to withhold the serious punishment that he was about to mete out against all the other sinful Israelites in this disgraceful episode. There's much to say about this. It's a little bit confusing, but one aspect of the Phinehas story is relevant to recovery in the sense that sexual acts and lack of self-control can be very bad in sobriety. This is why, for example, a lot of sponsors discourage newcomers from dating in early sobriety. Recovery is demanding. It's a demanding process, and it's a fragile environment for personal work, and it can be disrupted by the ups and downs of a romantic relationship or sexual intrigue. And then there's also a potential for an addict to transpose addictions. This is unfortunately very common, where someone might stop drinking or using drugs, but then act out compulsively in terms of sex and sort of transfer the addiction onto sex. And this is usually a disastrous scenario. And so what we can learn from the Phinehas story is that there may be a value in taking a decisive, seemingly harsh action in order to stop a behavior that's destructive and toxic. Numbers 25:14-25:15 reads, "The name of the slain Israelite who was slain by Phinehas was, with the Midianite woman, was Zimri, son of Salu, leader of a father's house of the Simeonites, and the name of the slain Midianite woman was Cozbi, daughter of Zur, who was the head of the peoples of a father's house in Midian." So, interpreting what this means is that both the man and the woman who were killed by Phinehas were a prince and a princess, respectively. Zimri was a prince of the tribe of Simeon. Cozbi was a princess of the land of Midian. And when they engaged in idol worship and illicit sex in public view of Moses, Phinehas killed them both in the name of heavenly righteousness. So one thing that's shocking about this moment is the realization that Midian, a country which people is now thought to be where Saudi Arabia is today, that Midian would send its most privileged women on a mission of such degradation to seduce the Israelite men and commit licentious acts in public just to demoralize the Israelites and cause them to surrender. You have to kind of imagine what this must have looked like. This can tell us something about the power of fear and resentments. The Midianites were so afraid of the Israelites, so consumed by fear and resentment of their advancing and success, that they basically prostituted their own daughters to try to stop the inevitable conquest. And we do this in addiction too. We may destroy what is most precious to us to avoid dealing with our fears. Our resentments drive us to toxic behavior that can kill us and ruin those around us. And look at Zimri. Being a prince of Israel was not enough to protect him from losing self-control. Status and accomplishment mean nothing in the face of raw, untreated addiction. Numbers 25:12-13 reads, "There say, behold, I," meaning God, "I give him," meaning Phinehas, "therefore I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his offspring after him a covenant of eternal priesthood, because he took vengeance for his God, and he atoned for the children of Israel." So this is a perplexing moment in the Bible. Phinehas, who has just killed two people, right or wrong, is being rewarded with a covenant of peace, an elevation to the level of priest. Does he deserve it? And it may not make sense on the surface. But for anyone who is ever out to take firm, distasteful action or undertake serious, tough love to help an addict recover, it makes perfect sense. Sometimes difficult decisions must be made, and actions that might otherwise be unthinkable must be taken to save someone's life. Phineas understood this. He knew that if he did not leap into action to stop this plague of idolatry and sexual immorality that was sweeping through the Israelite camp, that they would have been completely lost. They would have forfeited their right to enter the Promised Land. They would have been killed by the angry hand of God. So Phinehas's violent decision saved Israel. For this he was rewarded, and everyone else experienced peace. This is what it means to Phinehas to recover a covenant of peace. Recovery is about taking action. In some cases, the actions may seem extreme, but they may well be necessary. Well, let's just digress for one quick second on an aspect of this verse that might, if you were paying really, really close attention, you might have caught, which is that why isn't Phinehas already a priest? He's the grandson of Aaron. Aaron's the high priest, and Aaron's descendants are priests. So why is Phinehas not included? Why does he have to be elevated to the priesthood? And the answer is that when God bestowed the priesthood on Phinehas, on Aaron, and told Aaron that his descendants would be the priests for all time, that meant anybody who was not yet born. He said, you know, the priesthood would be Aaron and Eleazar, his son, and any of their descendants, but Phinehas was already alive, so he was excluded from this. But he wasn't grandfathered in, so to speak. Anybody born after him in that priest family would be a priest, so he was left out. So even what's interesting, I think, from recovery is that he didn't have a resentment about that. He was still ready to leap into action and do the will of God. Even he could have been sitting around sulking about not being included in the priesthood, but he chose not to, and maybe that can be an inspiration to us. Numbers 27:1 to 27:5 gets into a new story. It says, "The daughters of Zelophehad stood before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, and before the leaders and the entire assembly at the entrance to the tent of meeting, saying, 'Our father died in the wilderness, but he was not among the assembly that was gathering against God in the assembly of Korach, but he died of his own sins, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be omitted from among his family because he had no son? Give us a possession,'" meaning a possession of land in the Holy Land, "among our father's brothers." And Moses brought their claim before God. So what's going on here is that God has instructed Moses that the Holy Land, the land of Israel, was to be divided among the tribes. And there are some biblical scholars who have reconstructed what this map actually looked like. It's kind of interesting how the 12 tribes occupied the area of the world that is now the modern state of Israel, part of Lebanon, part of what's now Jordan, and so forth. The original, sort of original biblical land of Israel was divided into 12 kind of districts, I guess you could say. So each one would then be subdivided into parcels of land for each family. But the way it was originally brought down is it was based on the men. The men as head of households would have an assignment of land. So the daughters of Zelophehad bring forward this request that they too, since they don't have a brother, they too deserve to have their inheritance of the land of Israel. And Moses asks God, and God responds in Numbers 27:7, says, "The daughters of Zelophehad speak properly. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance." And I think that this story, in addition to being kind of a landmark moment of feminist Bible study, this story can teach us an important lesson about the process of recovery. The daughters had a legitimate grievance they wanted addressed. They were courageous to seek Moses' decision on this. It would have been easy for them to hold back out of fear of being ridiculed or punished and seethed with resentment. And you have to realize at this time in history, you know, women were not, women were not encouraged to act this way, and it was, you know, might have been even dangerous for them. But they believed that they had an important question, and they asked in a respectful way. But addicts can do the opposite. We want something that we feel we're entitled to, but we're afraid to advocate for ourselves, so we disappear into resentment and isolation, or we lash out, you know, angrily demanding things of people and getting the opposite of what we want. None of this is healthy. So the story of the daughters of Zelophehad should inspire us to find a solution to our problems through the help of an experienced advisor. You know, they went to seek the help of Moses in this, and what's interesting too is that Moses turned around and asked God. It was a question that even Moses couldn't answer off the top of his head. He took the question up to a higher authority himself. So that can inspire us to seek experienced guidance when we need it and not try and figure everything else out on our own. Numbers 27:12 reads, God said to Moses, "Go up this mountain of Abiram and see the land I have given to the children of Israel." So, as we learned earlier in Numbers 27, God will not allow Moses to enter the land, will not enter the promised land, as punishment for his earlier transgressions of hitting the rock. However, God allows Moses to see the land from the top of a mountain. This might seem a little unfair or even cruel. Like, here you get to see it, but you can't go there, even though you've been working your whole life in order to get there and get these people there. But it's actually an act of kindness. Moses longs to see the land, even if he can't go there. And the fact that the children of Israel will get to enter the land is an immense triumph for Moses, the culmination of his dream and his life's work as a prophet. So the moment is bittersweet, to say the least. And recovery presents similar moments. We may never get to where we want to go, truly, but we will be rewarded for trying. Like Moses, too, we may personally fail in our mission, but our work with others will propel them to success they dream about. Recovery is a cyclical process. We can be led to the top of the mountain to be shown where we might go if we work hard. Then, perhaps we aren't able to accomplish what we need to do and get there in one cycle, but we can try again with God's help and forgiveness. Numbers 27:15-27:18 reads, Moses spoke to God, saying, "May God, God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the assembly, who shall go out before them and come in before them, who shall take them out and bring them in, and let the assembly of God not be like sheep that have no shepherd." God said to Moses, "Take to yourself Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom there is spirit, and lean your hand upon him." Moses, at this moment, realizes that the time has come to find someone to take over for him. God tells him how to identify the right person, which is Joshua. He says, "Lean your hand upon Joshua." And leaning of hands, which you imagine sort of pressing your hands on someone's shoulders, was a signified transition of leadership from one generation to the next. And what's interesting is that this is currently how rabbis are ordained, actually, still. They're leaned on, and this tradition is said to go all the way back to Moses. And we have leaders in recovery, too. According to the traditions, they are trusted servants. They do not govern. So, too, were Moses and Joshua. They were trusted servants of God, trusted by people to lead. They were not politicians. Leadership in recovery programs is critical. AA leaders are role models. They need to be trusted servants who derive their authority from the God consciousness of the program. When it works incredibly. And as an example of how this leadership can be put into action, I heard us share from a man. This is a man who had been in and out of prison for stealing when he was active in his addiction. So he got sober early on and may have even been on a court order. He went to an AA meeting and the group leader met him and said, "I'm going to make you the treasurer of this meeting." He handed him an envelope full of money and said, "Take this home and keep account of it." And this man was so shocked that anybody would trust him like this, that this, you know, like this is a man who had been in prison for theft. But it was this act of trust that was partly responsible for turning his life around. The leader of this AA meeting must have sensed something about him, and he realized that if he could be trusted like this, he could be a better person. It was a tremendous act of leadership to entrust him with the group's money, and it worked.
You've been listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible. www.foriwillbewithyou.com